Greetings and welcome to another episode of Poetry Cast. I'm your host, Jonathan Stone. Today we're going to return to reading and discussing the sonnets of Pablo Neruda, which, if you haven't tuned in before, I've been translating for quite some time. I have no idea when I'm going to finish, but I rather enjoy the process. And really, the process is what it's all about. In fact, that's what writing's all about. Really, process. If you're listening to this podcast, then you're probably a writer and you know what I'm talking about. I just finished translating Sonnet 60 of Neruda's Cien Sonetos de Amor. I have to add that thus far the sonnets for this section, Tarde, are not my favorite. I'm not sure if I'm just not happy with the way I've translated them, or whether I'm not feeling inspired, or if I just don't feel as close to these poems as I did with the others, for whatever reason. I should further explain the layout of the sonnets so you know what I'm referring to. His 100 sonnets are divided into four sections: Mañana, Mediodía, Tarde and noche, or morning, afternoon, evening, and night. Of course, this is a symbolic layout, but I'm not quite sure yet of what I believe to what this layout most closely refers, whether it refers to the different phases of his life, or more likely the different phases of his relationship with Matilda, his wife, to whom the sonnets are dedicated. Either way, it's certainly a progression through time, both through his writing of the sonnets, through his life and the act of aging, as well as through my reading and consequently my own writing of the sonnets through translation. Today I plan on reading two of his sonnets, as well as a poem by a contemporary of Neruda's, the Irish poet William Butler Yeats. Now, I don't believe Yeats ever met Neruda, nor do I know if he ever read his work, but they were nevertheless contemporaries, and I think we can find some interesting parallels in their styles and themes, though I'm clearly not going to supply enough examples that would satisfy the demands of any kind of academic analysis. Regardless, I think you'll still find our comparisons educational and perhaps even enlightening. Yeats was a patriotic Irish poet who witnessed the bloodshed between the Irish Republican Army and the English government. However, he was also against the violence and seemed to be in favor of a diplomatic solution. It's interesting to note that we can trace the tactics of the IRA to those of Al-Qaeda, e.g. car bombings and small but multiple acts of terrorism. I'm not saying that the two were ever allied. In fact, I have hardly any knowledge of the history between the two groups. The tactics of Al-Qaeda were indeed inspired by those of the IRA. The point of this little bit of information is just to show how similar our world is to Yeats's. It seems human relationships have always been and always will be quite complicated and impossible to simply pin down and resolve in a psychiatrist's office or within the walls of a government building. Furthermore, this is the very reason for people to write poetry, to express oneself to others and to analyze that same self. In this process, we open the book to communication and therefore understanding, thus closing the gap that exists between people, and even the gap that exists within ourselves, that canyon between the self and the understanding of the self. Political turmoil was also prevalent in Neruda's own Chile, which led to his forced exile from his beloved homeland. Indeed, are we not all individuals exiled from our society to some degree? Poets especially seem to carry that stigma of living on the fringes of their society. Their work is both vital to a nation, yet often shunned at the same time. F. Scott Fitzgerald's famous aphorism that concerns the test of intelligence, as well as what I believe is a defining characteristic of human existence altogether, is worth mentioning here, which is, he says, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." Is this not the seemingly contradictory nature of the poet? To both praise and to criticize his society and his work, as well as to criticize himself? Well, now that I've introduced our topic for this cast, let's hear some poetry. The first one is by William Butler Yeats called Sailing to Byzantium, and it's from his book The Tower, first published in 1928. That is no country for old men. The young, in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song, the salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long. Whatever is begotten, born, and dies, caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing, for every tatter in its mortal dress, nor is there singing school but studying monuments of its own magnificence, and therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire, and fastened to a dying animal. It knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling, to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium, or what is past, or passing, or to come. As you heard, Yeats is speaking about aging, which is rather odd, being that he was quite young when he wrote this poem. Nevertheless, this is one of Yeats' subjects to which he returned over and over, our all-too-human awareness that we are always aging, and the only time that we stop aging in our lives is when they are over. Yeats reminds us that aging is a journey that we all undertake, and it's also not necessarily the most dignifying journey. But what it lacks in physical pleasure, it makes up for in intellectual pursuits. There isn't much controversy over the connotations of his line, and fastened to a dying animal, that refers to his heart, which also ages and dies along with the rest of his body. Furthermore, we can also recall one of his earlier lines, an aged man is but a paltry thing, to reinforce Yeats' sentiment involving aging that he invokes in this poem. Notwithstanding his negative sentiments, this is a more positive outlook that refers to Byzantium, a fictional city, but also a metaphor for the destination of his creative pursuits. The city is literally fictional in that Yeats created it, recreated it, more or less, and it also refers to all poetic fictions, of which itself it is one. Byzantium is heaven, it is Shangri-La. It is both the Troy of Homer as well as the Troy of Achilles. In other words, it exists as a monument, an inspiration for others to marvel at, or even to conquer. It is a direction for poets to look toward when they write. It is the Mecca that we kowtow toward when we seek divine inspiration. We must keep in mind that it's not the object itself that is important, but the reverent feelings that object invokes. Now let's take a look at a poem by Neruda, which grapples with similar thoughts, but Neruda takes a slightly different road toward Byzantium. Instead of seeking his holy city through poetic inspiration, instead he follows the path of love to find a city, and even build a house there. Here is Neruda's Sonnet 54 from Escien Sonetas de Amor, as translated by myself. Splendid reason, clear demon, from dense branches, from honest afternoon, here we are at the end, bereft of solitude, but alone, far from the delirium that is Jerusalem. When the pure ray conceals its plumed dove, and the fire varnishes the peace with its tongues, we are the ones who raise the celestial result. Reason and stripped love dwell in this divine home. Furious dreams, rivers of bitter certainty, decisions more tempered than the dreams of the sword, they, yes, they, we add to the lover's chalice on the scale. That is until reason and love are added to the opposite chalice, as complementary as two feathered wings. This is how we craft our clarity. Right away, you'll probably notice the city of Jerusalem mentioned here. I should first say that in the original poem, Neruda never mentions Jerusalem. The original phrase is literally translated as the city of salvation, but I decided that Jerusalem would offer some of the same significance for contemporary readers, if not more. So I used some of my poetic license and stuck with it. Hopefully you'll agree that it sounds right, which is what I'm trying to do. As you can also see, Neruda refers to a craft that he endeavors to perfect, whereas Yeats referred to hammered gold and gold enameling to describe the actions of his craft through the analogy of a smith. Neruda is building a divine home, where love rather than literature is inspiration, and similarly describes his craft through the analogy of a carpenter. However, let's take a look at another one of Neruda's poems from the section of his book Tarde, which he directly refers to hardened literature. This is Sonnet 58, four poems later in his book, as translated once again by myself. Between the blades of hardened literature, I pass as ancient mariner, familiar with the currents, who can sing as if there were nothing beyond the corners, beyond the text. From the distant archipelago, a tempest carries my accordion with its gusts, with its spells of thunder, and through the tradition it fills with lush objects, the definitions of my wild heart. Like this, the teeth of literature lunge toward my honest talons. I leave singing with the winds, toward the stores of rain from my childhood, toward the frozen forests of the indefinable south, toward my life that fills with your aroma. Here it appears that despite his journeys and engagements with literature, Neruda always returns to his love, toward his life that fills with her aroma. Once again, these are sonnets, and as sonnets they are, as the tradition would have it, dedicated to love. Yeats, too, has plenty of poems that praise love. Has there lived a poet who didn't? There is little reason why love would not be celebrated by poets. Besides being one of the most potent and wild emotions, love is a bond that unites us. Just as literature is a medium for communication, so is love a medium for bonding us to others. Let's not forget how truly lonely a literary pursuit can be. Communication of literature is indirect communication, a discourse where the speaker and the listener are not physically close at all. But love is direct, and it's also physical and emotional rather than mediated through language. Of course, on the opposite end of the unmediated spectrum of communication is, as we mentioned before, terrorism, complete lack of love, as well as a lack of verbal communication altogether. It is an act of violence, which does indeed send a message, but one that is antithetical to building a society. So this is where language and literature can serve human societies, by opening lines of communication, that is, by creating a discourse. And finally, this is where literature and love find themselves overlapping in their purposes. They both enable human relationships to prosper, as well as inspire our societies to flourish. I hope you enjoyed today's poetry cast. I apologize if I went a little overboard with the relationship between love and literature, but it's important, relevant, and I think it was worth mentioning in this episode. Until next time, I appreciate your subscription, and please tell your friends about this podcast. And finally, if you have any questions or comments, you can contact me at poetrycast@yahoo.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll engage once again in discourse of poetics and poetry next time.